There was a time, and not that long ago, as a matter of fact, when most people just thought of beer as, well, beer. But with a growing appreciation of all kinds of beers, craft beers, a surge in the number of home brewers, lots of them, there's a beer, I think, for every palate to enjoy, and then some. And we're happy to have David Ryder with us today to talk about the myths and magic of beer. David is Vice President of Brewing Research, Innovation, and Quality at MillerCoors. He's been at MillerCoors for the past 20 years or so in various technical capacities. And before that, he was kind of a self-described gypsy brewer. He worked in over 20 countries and 5 continents in breweries, both large and small, originally from London, England. And David, it's great to have you with us today.
Well, Larry, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for allowing me to be on your show. Great honor.
At one point, you were called Dr. Bubbles.
Yeah, that was way back in 1998. It was the Wall Street Journal. They wrote an article about me because my research activities over the years have sort of, you know, led me to do a few strange things. And working with a colleague of mine, one of my old colleagues who is now retired, he spent 30 years of his life researching beer bubbles. And that's a true story. And so he became, if you like, the world's expert on beer bubbles. And of course, I had the honor and the pleasure of working with him. So we research beer bubbles together. We can adjust beer bubbles. We know the molecular structure of beer bubbles and everything else. And we can enhance beer bubbles if we want to, things like that. And it's all done very, very naturally. You know, beer is a natural product, and we respect that totally.
And we have, by the way, I this is really cool. Up on my Facebook page, we have a lecture that David Ryder gave. And it was about hops, and I haven't heard the whole thing yet or watched the whole thing. I started, and I saw the first 20 minutes or so, and bubbles come right up in that discussion.
Right. You know, hops are magical ingredients, and I think that many people sort of, you know, underestimate the properties of hops. For example, hops were first used because of their antimicrobial properties in beer and stopped nasty things from actually growing in beer. Beers, naturally, when drunk in moderation, beer is, you know, naturally healthy. But the antimicrobial things, nasty things can actually grow in beer, but not pathogenic microorganisms. So you're not going to get Salmonella or Shigella or Cryptosporidium because they don't grow in beer. But things that can spoil beer do. So you've got the antimicrobial properties from hops. You've got this desirable bitterness from hops, which only hops can actually provide. And then you've got flavor and aroma. And that's divided up into three categories of citrus, floral, and herby spicy. And that's a complex subject in itself. Way back in the mid-90s, we also found that hops give a certain mouthfeel to beer. And we took advantage of that. It's basically the glycosides in the hops which actually do this. Really, really interesting. And then to your point, Larry, hops add to foam and the way the bubbles look, things like this, the amount of foam that we have in a beer. So all that is really, really magical stuff.
Oh, it is. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. Do you enjoy beer? Or maybe talk about your favorites. Maybe you're a home brewer. Or maybe you're interested in getting started. David certainly has some great advice to share. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and we would certainly love to hear from you. What's the oldest proof we have of beer making?
Well, that's a really interesting question, Larry, and thanks for asking that. You know, I just love the history of beer. So I try to go back as far as I can. And of course, as you know, there are remnants of beer and, of course, wine from your previous speaker that go back thousands of years. Was interesting, you know, Sumerian tablets about 6,000 years old depict barley being used to make a drink that made people feel exhilarated, wonderful and blissful. And to this day, when drunk in moderation beer will actually make you do that, make you feel exhilarated, wonderful and blissful. You know, the ancient Egyptians, they had sonnets about beer. They used to write poems, sonnets, all sorts of things about beer. One of them in ancient Mesopotamia says that when I have an abundance of beer, I feel great. My heart is full of joy and my liver is full of luck. Now, the problem with the ancient Egyptians was that from time to time they used to over-imbibe. So if you go down the ancestral throat, you kind of find these, you know, other sonnets as well and things like this. And this one goes back to when they did have a bit of a hangover. And it says, last evening you were drinking deep, so now your head aches, go to sleep. Take some boiled cabbage when you wake, and that's the end of your headache. And this is really interesting because...
Boiled cabbage.
If you do have a hangover, and we would never recommend that you do, but if you do have one, if you eat some cabbage, that's going to get rid of your hangover. Probably why the Germans invented sauerkraut. I don't know.
Great story.
I tell you.
David Ryder, our guest, Vice President of Brewing Research, Innovation, and Quality at MillerCoors. And with us today to talk about the myths and magic of beer. And what do you mean by the myths and magic of beer?
Well, you know, there's so many things that, I mean, people love to talk about beer. And now it's, you know, fabulous with the smaller breweries and so on who make all these different beer styles. And we think that that's really great because you have these beer styles coming up and so on. But some of the beer styles and, you know, some of the things might not necessarily be totally correct, and but you know, lots of things have been written about beer. Now, if we go back to ancient Egyptian times, there used to be different styles of beer, much as there are today. Beer was made in a similar way to the way that beer is made today. No real shortcuts or anything like that, but there were dark beers and there were light-colored beers and there were different kinds of things to keep the palate happy of the, you know, the ancient Egyptian. And there's tablets in Mesopotamia that describe the making of these different beer styles. Matter of fact, a Dogfish Head, one of the smaller breweries who's now becoming very successful, they have gone back to try to make beer from that time using the ancient ingredients. So, but in those days, beer had sort of three names in Mesopotamia. One was called Hek, one was called Hemke, and the third name was Buza. And that's where that word comes from.
Oh, right?
That actually comes from beer. And of course, Hek shops or pubs, in those days, they were called Hek shops. They became very, very numerous because people love to drink beer, much as they do today. And of course, the local authorities tried to close down the Hek shops. It was a kind of a form of early prohibition. It didn't work then. It doesn't work now, so, you know. And then in those days also, beer was considered to be a bit of a medicine. It's recorded in the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead because some of the things about beer, you know, the mineral content, the trace element content, there are some anti-cancer compounds in beer from the hops and things like this. So there's all sorts of things about beer that, again, can be healthful. I mean, still given the fact that it does contain a moderate amount of alcohol. And it's very interesting because way back when, of course, there weren't billboards. There weren't televisions and things like this. So the healthful properties of beer in those days were passed from, you know, hand to, you know, just down the line. And things like, you know, the medicinal uses of beer are said to be a complexion restorer, which it probably is today, to cure fevers, to prevent you from leprosy, when drunk in moderation, to prevent impotency, fiend sickness or devil sickness, stop that, stop lunacy, and much like today, it's an appetite and digestion promoter. So, you know, and Larry, did you know that if you had stiff knees in those days, all you had to do was rub some beer into your stiff knees, and that would alleviate the pain there? Those are some of the reputed medicinal uses of beer way back when, apart from being a blood purifier and a brain food as well.
David Ryder, our guest.
D'Angelo and Jim Falls has a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Let's go there. D'Angelo, hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I'm 15, so I'm not, you know, a beer drinker. But right. I was wondering if there are different ways to make beer.
Yes, there are. There's many different ways to make beer. Now, I mean, first of all, you've got basically two types of yeast, if you like. You've got your ale yeasts and you've got your lager yeasts. We use both. But the one important thing is we have to keep our yeast happy. Now, one of the things which we rely on is microbiologists who understand the physiology of yeast so that we can understand its biochemistry and therefore keep the yeast happy. Now typically, an ale will take about 10 to 15 days to make. A lager will take, you know, anywhere from 3 weeks upwards to months to make, depending upon the kind of lager which you're trying to make. And then, depending upon the types of barley you use and the types of hops you use, you can come up with an infinite array of different flavors and colors and things like this. Now, there is in Belgium, you know, there is a way of making beer. It's called spontaneous fermentation, and the type of beer which is made there is called lambic or gerst. If it's you know, if this particular beer, it takes about 2 years to make this beer. It goes through a spontaneous fermentation of microorganisms which actually come from the air. And I've made this beer, I participated, you know, in the actual brewing of the beer. Of course, 2 years later, it sort of actually becomes this sour lambic or sour gerst. After that, people can add various fruits to it. So if you add a sort of raspberries to the beer and it goes through another fermentation of, say, about 6 months, it becomes framboise. If you add cherries to it, it becomes a beer which is known as creek. And if you add peaches to it, it becomes a beer which is known as pêche. All these beers are very tart, but this beer is a particular style that is very much enjoyed by the Belgians.
Oh, that's a great story. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. So the main types of beer are the ales and the lagers.
Yes, it's sort of very interesting. We like to look at it from the point of view of family trees, if you like. We like to say that there's the lager family tree, that there's the ale family tree, and then there's the kind of other beer styles, which is like the one I just described.
Yeah, and you know what? We're going to talk some more about that. We need to take a quick look at the news and the weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network as we visit with David Ryder, Vice President of Brewing Research, Innovation, and Quality at Miller Coors. He's been at Miller Coors for 20 years but has lots more experience in over 20 countries on 5 continents in breweries, both large and small. He'll be with us right up until 12:30. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Plato said he was a wise man who invented beer. And we're spending some time today talking about the history, future, or brewing of beer with our guest, Larry Mueller here, my guest expert, Dave Ryder. David Ryder is Vice President of Brewing Research, Innovation, and Quality at Miller Coors. He's been at Miller Coors for 20 years in various capacities. Before that, he served and worked in over 5 continents in breweries, both large and small, originally from London, England. And David, again, thanks for spending time with us today. Appreciate it very much.
It was a great pleasure, Larry. Thank you for having me today.
We have callers online. If you have a question for David, I hope you'll join in, maybe about history or maybe about the current beer or the types of beer. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Lynn in Eau Claire has been waiting a while, so let's go there to her. Lynn, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and David. I'm not a beer connoisseur. I haven't found a lot of light beers. I haven't found one that I particularly like. But I do like stout, couple times a year. Just while I think it's complex, people complain to me that it's so bitter. How can I drink it? I don't find it really exceptionally bitter. And I'm wondering what makes it so wonderfully amazing with ice cream.
Well, Lynn, thank you for asking that particular question. And let me just say that you got great taste and everything else. Matter of fact, women throughout the history of beer have you know, always been actually recognized, notably, first of all, because it was women that used to make beer. Men used to go off to war and things like this, but you know, women made the beer, and they made the different types of styles going right back to ancient Egyptian times and so on. And it's also true to say, and I didn't know this, you know, when I joined the industry, but actually women are the best beer tasters. Now, that is a scientific fact. Ah. They have the best taste buds and everything else. And while men believe they can taste beer, and I like to believe I can taste beer, we're just not as good as women. The best tasters in the world are women. And in the company I work with, all the best tasters are actually women, the top tasters in the entire organization. But you know, that aside, first of all, we've just worked with Leinenkugel to come out with a Snowdrift Vanilla Porter. And I think, as you know, Lynn, porters are related to stouts. Porters were first made in England, in London, made with very hard waters, or, you know, waters which contain a lot of dissolved salts and things like this. The porters made their way to Ireland after a while, where there's also rather hard water. And there was an enterprising young brewer in the 1700s. His name was Arthur Guinness. And he decided to make a stout porter. And, of course, that became known as Arthur Guinness's Stout. So those beers are actually related. The wonderful thing is that these beers, to your point, Lynn, they really do go well with ice cream. It's nice to be able to actually pour some of these beers over ice cream. One of the beers coming out of Leinenkugel right now is a beer which is called Big Eddie Russian Imperial Stout. Oh. And that is a wonderful, wonderful product. It's a little bit strong on the alcohol, about 9% alcohol by volume. But if you pour it over ice cream, it's just a beautiful beer to have. And certainly we would encourage you to at least try that. And there are other stouts as well.
Yeah,
tried that. Yeah.
That's great stuff. Did you like it?
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah. I'm an amateur culinary artist, so I read and I research what I put in my mouth. Yeah, Imperial Stouts. I mean, there's a story behind them, and they're amazing.
Well, you know, they must be drunk with respect. I mean, things like an Imperial Russian Stout, a sipping beer. And if you've got a good brandy snifter, you know, pour it into that and just drink it, you know, with a sipping, because that's the best way to actually appreciate it. But, you know, over ice cream, particularly vanilla ice cream, can be absolutely magical. Now, the wonderful thing about stouts, of course, is the fact that there are all sorts of different roasted malts that can be used. There can be roasted barley, which is used. So you've got these roasted and toasted malts. You've got roasted barley. And depending upon how the actual stout is made up, depends upon how these different tastes are actually sort of translated. Of course, the tastes are translated together with the hops. So, of course, you know, it depends what hops or what variety of hops you actually use. Together. And this Snowdrift Vanilla Stout, which I was talking about a couple of minutes ago, is just a typical a type of very smooth beer that certainly goes very, very well with ice cream due to the malts and due to the hops which are being used.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
Chris in Sparta. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry, and hi, David. How are you doing today?
Hey, great. Chris.
I have a question. I am an IPA drinker. I like a stronger hoppy beer. I don't like, I consider more what people call full flavor or light beers to taste kind of watery to me, and I like to have that flowery bite.
Right.
And the first thing I do when I pour a beer is I smell it. I like the smell, and I judge a beer by smell before I taste it. Now, my question is this. Well, being that we're in Wisconsin here, IPAs aren't very big, so it's tough for me to find a good IPA that I like, or it's even tougher to find some of the more mainstream ones that are mass-produced. But when I do find them, they're always in coolers. And this is another thing about the people of the United States of America is that we drink our beer cold. I prefer to drink my IPAs warm, and my question is there a way to take a cold beer, bring it to room temperature, and enjoy it without having it go, as people describe, skunk, without changing, disrupting the flavor?
Yeah.
You know, that is a great question, Chris. It really is. Just for the listeners, just a little bit of history about sort of IPAs or India Pale Ales. These were produced way back by the British, and they were loaded in barrels on boats to be able to sail across to India. And because beer could spoil and could change the taste, these beers were highly hopped, and they were quite alcoholic as well to survive the journey. Of course, the other side, when they got to India, the idea was to dilute them to make them less alcoholic. Whether people did or didn't, you know, we don't know. But the point being is there's just some wonderful recipes for IPAs in the world, and that's a very brief history. You know, the wonderful thing about, you know, India Pale Ales is that, Chris, they can be balanced, but some of them are not balanced at all. And I concur with you that if you find a nice IPA that's balanced, where the hopping balances the amount of residual extract in the beer, then that can be really nice. And as you say, Chris, served at the right temperature. Because people make the mistake of cooling IPAs down, and a flavorful beer like that, particularly if it has these floral flavors or citrusy flavors, needs to be able to be drunk at a temperature somewhere between 40 and 50 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe even a little bit more than that, depending upon that. Now, if you take an IPA out of a refrigerator and you warm it up, it will not go skunky. And if it does go skunky, then there's something very, very wrong with the actual beer itself. But I've taken IPAs which have been cooled down. I've warmed them up to ambient temperature to even drink them at ambient, depending upon the temperature outside. But that's the best way of actually drinking an IPA, not cold, maybe cooler than ambient. But you can certainly warm them up, and they should never, ever go skunky. And maybe we'll have another question on skunkiness in a few minutes, because there's a long story about that as well.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris. And maybe talk about skunkiness. At one time, I had a friend who drank a particular beer that would often be turned skunky. Now, this is years and years ago.
Right. Well, you know, typical skunkiness, Larry, is a reaction between sunlight or ultraviolet light and the hops. And typically, the way the actual reaction works is that the light reacts with a molecular branch of the hop. And it creates, without going to a long story, it creates a compound which is called 3-methyl-2-butene-1-thiol. And that is skunky flavor. That is the odor that skunks emit. And this is really interesting because back in the old days, if you were to put beer in a clear glass bottle, it was very easy for the sunlight to react with the hops inside the beer and cause the beer to go skunky. And some beers in the marketplace in clear glass bottles can go skunky in as little as 2 minutes, you know, in
wow.
the sunlight. It's just unbelievable. But, you know, years ago when people discovered that these beers in clear glass bottles, which look nice, can go skunky, then it was a quest to be able to prevent that from actually happening. And now we have, for some beers, we have these light stable hops, which are produced naturally again, which can prevent the beer from actually going skunky, even if it's packaged in a clear glass bottle.
Very interesting. And Patrick and DePere, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello. Hi. Yeah, this is Patrick. Yes, I was wondering, years ago, back in the 60s, I worked in a little place in Milwaukee which produced products for brewing beer and for making cheese, and one of them was a hop extract. And nowadays, there's a lot of shortcuts taken in commercial breweries that people never did years ago, and it took a longer time to make beer. Nowadays, commercial breweries put out beer quite fast. And I was wondering if you could describe some of these commercial shortcuts versus the way beer used to be brewed. Mm-hmm. And, well, I'll just hang up and listen, okay?
Okay. All right. Thanks for calling. Thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, you know, Patrick, thank you for that question. First of all, if you are a home brewer, if there's anybody on the phone who actually is a home brewer, congratulations, because, you know, it is so difficult to be able to brew a good beer, and certainly it was even more difficult to brew a consistent beer when you're home brewing, because you're doing everything on a small scale, and it's so, so difficult to be able to get everything right. Now, commercial brewing, to be honest with you, and I'm being honest now, because, you know, I don't know of any shortcuts that commercial brewers make. Now, there might be some out there, but I've worked in a lot of breweries around the world, and typically, beers are going to be made for the correct amount of time. They are going to be made with different types of malts and different types of hops, and for Pilsner type beers made with soft water, for other types of beers with hard water, and we discussed earlier about porters and so on. I just honestly don't know of that. Having said that, though, the more we understand about yeast is natural, totally natural. The more we understand about pure yeast cultures, then we can think about producing beers at, say, slightly higher fermentation temperatures for certain styles. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But I honestly, and certainly we don't, employ any shortcuts to be able to make beer. I just don't know how you do that, you know?
Yeah, okay. All right, thanks very much for calling. Dave Anasio, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Well, hi there, Larry. So much beer, so little time. But among the many ones I enjoy is a style called Kolsch. I've found that refreshing. And I've never heard a definition of what exactly comprises a Kolsch style of beer.
No, Dave, thank you for that, because that's a really, really topical question. We got together with Leinenkugel, this year, to come out with a Kolsch-style beer, which is called Leinenkugel Canoe Paddler. It's a brilliant Kolsch. Well, of course, I'm biased, but, you know, what happened was that I didn't understand what a Kolsch beer was. So I had to go back and do the research and everything else, and found out that the Kolsch style is about 100 years old, just over 100 years old, made in Cologne in Europe. There are three breweries in Cologne that make this Kolsch-style beer, and they're very proud of this. And what they wanted to do was to produce a summery beer. So it's light in color. It uses specific hops to be able to take in the floral and citrus characters and maybe the herbal spicy flavors as well, to be able to get to what you want to get to. So when we were liaising with Leinenkugel for what they eventually called Canoe Paddler, we had to research the style, and we had to be very careful not to over-hop the beer, because it's very delicate, and we had to use the right kinds of hops, from around the world to be able to do that. But we're proud of what we actually produced in the end. Now, my quest, Dave, to your point, is to get to Cologne and to maybe do a market survey over there to be able to taste the different Kolsches over there. We got some in to taste, but I'm not satisfied that I've done enough of market activities to truly appreciate the different types of Kolsch that there might be. But it's a nice, light, bright, summery beer with a very delicate hopping.
Thank you, David, for calling. Appreciate it. And let's see. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Jacob in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello there. Yes, I'm wondering what the process behind creating new flavors of beer are. And like a previous caller had mentioned, 99 bottles of beer on the wall. 99 bottles of beer. Pick one up. Pass it around. 98 bottles of beer on the wall. 98 bottles of beer on the
All right. Well, we can't go through the whole 100.
Okay. All right. That's great. And great singing, by the way, Jacob. You know, that was really terrific. The whole beer scene is becoming more complicated, which is a good thing. I mean, it's good that people are being able to get all these different styles of beer and things like that. So it's becoming complicated. I just appreciate the fact that there are all these brewers out there these days, you know, all over the country and also in Wisconsin that have done a fabulous job, you know, of making these beers. I mean, right here, right down the road from the studio in which I'm in with Larry, we've got, we've got Euglaris, and so with Dan and Deb Carey and so on. They make some brilliant beers and so on, and it's just great that these different styles of beers keep on coming up, and brewers keep sort of challenging themselves to be able to make these different things. Where's it all going? Well, you know, there's a lot of different things which people are experimenting with. We've spoken about IPAs, we've spoken about porters and stouts, we've spoken a bit about ales and so on. But, you know, there's more and more bocks, there's more and more amber lagers, there's when we talk about things like, you know, lager or bottom fermenting beers, that's where the yeast settles at the bottom. You've got your Pilsners, you've got your Dortmunders, you've got your stronger lagers and American malt liquors, you've got your Vienna types, which are kind of reddish in color, or you've got your Mürzen and Oktoberfest beers, you've got your Munich pales. You've got your Rausch beers, which are made with peated malt, so they have a typical peaty flavour, and your dark box and so on, pale box and double box. That's really great. With the ale family tree, you've got things like sweet stouts, oatmeal stouts, dry stouts, imperial stouts, which we've spoken about. You've got your English brown ales, your old ales, your barley wines, which are, of course, strong beers, about 11% alcohol by volume. And you've got your bitters and your best bitters and your milds and things like this. You've also got your actual American pale ales and your cream ales. And cream ales, you know, typical American style, which was popularized by the Genesee Brewing Company in Rochester, New York. And, of course, you've got your India pale ales and you've got your Belgium ales, your Saisons. You know, some of the Belgium ales, which I like, are typically your Trappist ales. And in Belgium, there are 5 Trappist abbeys, and they produce, you know, so the beer's made by the monks. And there's some wonderful beers such as Orval, Chimay, Rochefort. My goodness, just great beers there. And then with the other beer styles that we're likely to see for the future is like the spontaneous beers, the sour beers, the tart beers, which are becoming popular now, or to be able to think about Berliner Weisse, or, you know, a typical beer made in Berlin in Germany, which is typically sour and typically served with a sugary syrup, such as a raspberry syrup or a green syrup, which is called Woodruff. Well, so that's interesting. And then, of course, you've got your Weiss beers, and some of those beers are very spicy in flavor. Some of the beers are not. Depends from where they come from. But plenty to choose from for the future, and I'm sure we're going to see a lot of that.
What are the most unusual beers that you've tasted?
Well, you know, Larry, thanks for asking that question, because, you know, every year there's a Great American Beer Festival in Denver, Colorado. Mm-hmm. And they come up with some of the strangest beers at times. You know, not bad beers, but just strange beers. The strangest beer, to my taste, is a beer that was made, you know, flavored with actually rosemary.
Oh.
And that was a little bit of an overwhelming beer for my palate. But having said that, I'm sure that there are people that might enjoy that.
Whoa. Rosemary. What's your favorite? What style, at least?
Well, my favorite beer is the one that's in my hand at the time, you know. So, but, you know, no, I mean, you know, we produce some nice beers that I like, and the competition produces nice beers. Love to go to Belgium and drink some of those Belgium ales down there, be it a Trappist ale or be it something like Duvel, which, of course, Duvel is Flemish for devil, and the beer is 8.5% alcohol by volume. So we have to be careful on that one, but great tasting beer.
Well, this has been a real pleasure, David, to have you with us today. And I'm sorry we didn't get to, we have so many questions. I hope maybe we can get you back and come back and do this again sometime.
Larry, that would be a great pleasure. Again, thank you for having me on the show. It's been just, it's been fantastic. And and thanks to all the people who have called in, because it really is a great pleasure to try to answer some questions.
David Ryder, our guest today, is Vice President of Brewing Research, Innovation, and Quality now at Miller. Now it's called Miller Coors. Been there for 20 years in a variety of technical capacities. And before that, he was kind of a gypsy brewer, as he describes himself. Worked in over 20 countries and five continents in breweries, large and small, originally from London, England. We'll try and get him back and do this again. Really appreciate it. And I appreciate you listening in. Tomorrow we'll take a look at the Comet Ison at 11, and then 11:45, bioenergy is our topic. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.